There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
He reminds me of, there's an Eddie Izzard skit where he's like, about when God drew the animals and then he got to the giraffes and his hand just sort of slipped and went, oi! And that's how the neck ended up that way. Yeah. And you just look at Hall and he just looks too big. Like, yeah. he just looks unrealistically big.
He looks like the kind of kid who, if it was in medieval times, would be frightened of no man but terrified of thunder.
Oh, God. You really are full Pilkington today.
He does.
But he's got, like a small child's head still, and then his body looks like... He looks like... I might have said this before. He looks like someone's trying to draw a small child and then just accidentally made it way too big.
Let's start off in France, shall we? It's been reported that Lyon want to replace Memphis Depay and Jeff Rain Adelaide, who are both injured long-term, but they are anxious to tread carefully because they're fearful of stymieing some of the young players they have at the club. 16-year-old Ryan Shirky currently appears to be the standout example of them. He scored two, set up two, and won a penalty v Nantes in the Coupe de France last weekend and looks a very exciting prospect. Shirky's goals, Andy... Both came in the first 10 minutes of the game, and it was fantastic because you could see the non-players looking around going, what is this? Where's this come from? This wasn't in any of the scouting reports.
Yeah. And
has he got a big reputation in France already?
Big reputation.
Yeah.
It's only his second start. He made his senior debut just a couple of days after his 16th birthday. Hmm. When he was 15, he was ripping up the UEFA Youth League, and he was fantastic in that. And to impress to this sort of level, I think it's worth underlining that with the academy that Lyon have and have had, and the amount of players that they've produced, I mean, more recently we look at Lacazette, of course, Fekir, and then we go backwards in time, and you've got Benzema, Ben Arfa, and the first year I lived in France was, the first year I lived in Lyon was when Benzema and Ben Arfa came into the first team, and it was exciting. You know, they were coming to the end of that seven title wins in a row, but you know, they were just really going along the back of, especially Benzema for that season. And to come in at 16, which is an earlier point than either of those guys made a debut, because he's not 17 until next season. It's something that's quite remarkable for him to come through and people to say, is he one of the best talents that the academy's ever produced after two starts? I mean, that is not a small thing to say, because even when Lyon, post Claude Puel, were absolutely hemorrhaging money, and that they had a huge wage bill, they'd lost control on the sporting side. They had to reinvest in the academy at that point. That they overspent on a lot of players that didn't work out. Look at Edison, Yann Gourcuff, famously bad transfer. And I mean, Gourcuff, in one sense, the worst thing that happened with him is he kind of pushed out Miralem Pjanic, because Pjanic was like the anointed successor to Juninho. You know, Juninho got him on the phone.
He looks great now, Juninho, by the way.
And said, oh, what, the full, I'm back from a gap year.
Yeah, he looks amazing.
Yeah.
It looks like he works at, in Silicon Valley. Doesn't he? Graying beard, salt and pepper, glasses. He looks great.
Yeah, he looks the part, even if his record as sporting director is, I think I'd say mitigé at the moment. Anyway, it's interesting because Janino said, I want you to have this number 8 shirt to Miralem Pjanic. And then Gorkov comes and kind of nudges him out of the way.
Flutters his eyelashes.
That they end up... It's understandable. Yeah. You could fall for that. And they sell him to Roma and the rest is history. You know, Pjanic becomes a great Serie A player. And Pjanic is slightly different, of course, because he didn't come through the Lyon Academy. I remember in that year when Benzema and Ben Arfa first came through, so that would be, what, 2007, 2008, that they played a French Cup semi-final against Metz, and Pjanic turns up playing for Metz, who are bottom of the table. And Pjanic is so good that straight after the game, like, he's running rings around Juninho and Mathieu Bodmer and players like that. And straight after the game, Oles goes, right, we're going to have to buy him. We're going to have to buy him. And that's exactly what happens. But even though he didn't come through the academy, Pjanic, he is a symbol of how the academy got deprioritised. And when they were having to cut costs left, right and centre because of everything that went wrong under Claude Puel, all the money that was spent that didn't work out well, the only money they really spent was shoving money into the academy. Because, of course, that was the way to getting back to where they were. They kind of took their eye off the ball a little bit where that was concerned. But, you know, they've always continued to produce players. And even players that haven't worked out at Lyon, that have gone on to have good careers elsewhere, I suppose Loic Remy is one, Anthony Martial, who they were kind of forced to sell because of all the money they were losing at that point. They had to sell him to Monaco. Then he ended up going on to Manchester United. But Shirky, to come through and straight away, like, almost force a change in the club's transfer policy, because, right, okay, we've got to find a replacement for Memphis. And they've brought in Carl Toko Ekambi, who's got great Ligue 1 experience, a good Ligue 1 record with Angers, and he's got a decent record with Villarreal as well. So they've got this very favourable loan with an option to buy deal, which I suspect they'll take up the permanent option. I'd be surprised if they didn't. I think Toko Ekambi will do well. But the fact that they've been openly saying, we can't block Ryan, you know, we need to give him space. And interestingly, having played wide quite a lot for the youth teams of Lyon, he's someone who, because those skills have translated so well to senior match situations, and it's all very well seeing YouTube clips and seeing him put 15-year-olds on their arse or 16-year-olds on their arse or whatever, but to go into the first team and do that, for them to say, well, you know what, we're going to try him as a second striker because we're a bit short, and it's worked. And funnily enough, it's, you can't really compare him to Atem Ben Arfa, but that left foot, that audacity, there are parallels. And funnily enough, maybe if Atem Ben Arfa, people had looked at him a little bit earlier on and thought, well, maybe he would work as a second striker, perhaps his career might have been a little bit different.
And I think with Shirky, you watch that game, I don't think, if you didn't know before, I don't think you'd know he was 16. He looks like he's strong,
like
he's
the rangy. The beard's got, not bum fluff.
Almost a full beard, and that's a big testament to him that he does look like he belongs at that level. And we all have grown up, or we've all seen over a generation really now, that of these kind of kids who get a viral YouTube video that goes everywhere about how good they are. There was that kid at Barcelona a few years ago, and you don't sometimes you don't really hear them again, because the point you make is a good one, Andy, is that it doesn't actually mean anything until you get into the actual senior pros and see what you can do.
But I think that's one of the reasons why he is so exciting, is not just you know, sitting people down on their ass and going past people. You know, you get a lot of enormously talented teenagers, very technically gifted, but you see sort of qualities there, like the vision for the through ball for the third goal, was it? I mean, that kind of pass that he's able to play, that. So, I mean, that's more of a skill that that you can build on. That's not a coincidence. Like, that's not just being very technical and knowing a few tricks, you know, that sort of thing. And I remember seeing that with Martin Ødegaard when he first came through. It was like, it's all good doing a lot of nutmegs on like terrible defenders in the Norwegian league. I mean, you can do that, but you can see him finding passes that no one else could find. And if you can do that at 16, that's not something that's going to leave you.
And do you know what, really, that game where Lyon beat Nantes 4-3 in the Coupe de France, as I mentioned, it was a real great example of life comes at you quick, because in the goal for Nantes was, of course, Alban Lafont, who made his debut for Toulouse and he got 16 years old. And what goes to Fiorentina comes back to Nantes on loan. He's now, 20?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's picking the ball at the back of the net from some 16-year-old kid who keeps banging it past him. I felt for him. I have to say, I felt for him.
But Andy, like, it is remarkable you mention all the names that have gone through the Lyon Academy. Just having lived there and just followed the club very closely, like, can you tell us anything? Is there anything they do differently from anyone else? Like, why are they so enormously successful?
It's a great food scene in Lyon.
Could be that. With the academies, like with these generational talents, they're always going to come through, but it is remarkable, it's just the breadth of and the width of how many players who have been through there. And you just see across the French league, someone catches your eye, you know, he's really good. A lot of the times they'll turn up to have spent some time at the Lyon Academy.
Yeah, that's true. But actually, to go back to the food thing, before I answer that last...
Yeah, there's the thing.
Did you see the banner behind the goal complaining about... Paul Bocuse, or the late Paul Bocuse.
And if I did see it, crucially, I wouldn't have been able to read it.
His restaurant had its third Michelin star taken off it after 55 years.
Disgrace.
But obviously, because it's got such a gastronomical tradition, the Ultra has made a big banner going, you're not taking his third star
kind of Ultras.
Yeah.
Protesting.
Needless to say.
Not just losing, they're just taking one away. We're going from 3-2.
Yeah.
Which is very bad, of course. But.
Yeah. I mean, well, there's
don't see that at Fratton Park, Lars.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a theory that Michelin are just doing it for the... for the social media vibes. They're trying to make themselves too modern, and they're trying to make headlines. But back to those Lyon players. I think the notable thing about the academy, and it's not just the level of investment in it, it's the way that the players are given responsibility. Mm. And I think you see that in Cherki particularly. And something that really strikes me, I saw Claudio Beauvau, really good striker, really... interesting time he had at Guingamp, where he broke Didier Drogba's goal scoring record at Guingamp, which is no mean feat, and then he got a move to Lyon off the back of it. He's had a few injuries since, and playing in Spain for a bit. He was at Cannes last season, and now he's on he's gone to Deportivo La Coruña, where he can hopefully rebuild his career and get them back up the table. But when Beauvau arrived at Lyon, there was a big fuss, and Corentin Tolisso got himself in a lot of trouble because he went off for the French to play with the French under 21s, and he said, "Oh, Beauvau is hopeless. Like, he can't even trap the ball. He's not good enough to play for our team." And of course, a couple of the players who were on that French under 21 team, who were from Caen, gave him a ring straight, told their mates, and they gave him a ring straight away afterwards, and that caused a big kerfuffle in the dressing room. Tolisso was removed from the team for a couple of games, but I think that was quite indicative of something else. The fact that
the scene is so typically French.
Yeah, yeah. but if you're a big player, if you come to Lyon, you have to fit in with our culture.
Mm.
Not we have to play around you because you're the star. I think that's the interesting thing. The technical skills and what's required of Lyon Academy graduates is what sets the tone at the club. So it's not a sense of we are there to supplement the superstars. It's they are here to help us get along.
Hmm. Staying in France, I mean, let's talk about my PSG beat, is it Rennes last night?
Rennes
last night.
And with Lyon having beat Lille on penalties in the first semi-final of the Coupe de la Ligue, that means it's a Lyon-PSG final match ever in the Coupe de la Ligue, because of course they're abolishing it. So
next season,
the final in April is the final ever game in the competition.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk of perhaps doing that in this country as well. But so PSG won last night 3-0. 17-year-old Tanguy Kouassi got on the score sheet. Another exciting young player in France.
What did you make of his dance with Neymar, Lars?
That's the dream, isn't it? That's the dream. That's what you want to be doing.
Yeah,
is Neymar going to corrupt him the same way he corrupted Lionel Messi? That's what I want to know.
No, listen, I don't want to sound like the sort of old idiots who sort of keep talking about how Pogba has ruined Man United because he does a dance and he's on. So no, sure. Have a dance with Neymar. Why not?
You're a soft touch, arm around the shoulder coach,
yeah,
Lars, I can tell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it is exciting for PSG that they're bringing through, because logically PSG should be like one of the clubs in Europe that are bringing through the most talents, right?
Absolutely.
Because if you look across the last couple of decades, like there's so many incredibly talented players who come out of Paris and the suburbs around Paris. And PSG now, they have...
no other Paris teams either. So it's not that they're fighting anyone else to get them.
Well, there are, but they're sort of not quite as prestigious. So they have incredible pulling power to get the most gifted youngsters to come to them, and they really should. But there's always been this feeling that their glamour projects could threaten that, and the pathways could be completely blocked. So it's good to see him playing, and it's good to Dagba getting quite a lot of football. You know, this sort of thing.
But Lars, in terms of rivals, to put it in perspective, the second biggest team in Paris is Paris FC, who are about to be relegated from Ligue 2, right?
Red Star Paris are knocking about right now.
Jeremy Menez scored for Paris FC in the Coupe de France last weekend.
That's amazing. That is amazing. But I want to get on to the main thing with the original, in terms of this generation, kind of French superstars, of course, Kylian Mbappe. He gave a really interesting interview with the BBC last week, praising Liverpool, or this week, I think it was, praising Liverpool, saying he's committed to PSG. Who he thanked for making him a superstar, in his words, but crucially said, let's wait until the end of the season. Now, it's been noted that his English is like amazing as well. I was surprised how good his English was for such a young kid who spends all this time in France. When a player in this country says, look, let's just wait to the end of the season with a glint in his eye, we're kind of brought up to think, oh, that's interesting. Now, what I want to ask you guys is that just a fact that Mbappe is speaking in his second language and he didn't mean that? Or is it something we should read into? Because he is continually linked with a big money move to the Premier League.
Well, I think he answered a question about Liverpool because I asked him about Liverpool. I think that's something that's worth underlining straight away.
So boring, Andy.
But there's more. I keep the exciting bit for pudding. Mm. It's with Kylian Mbappe... You have to take notice of every word he says.
Right.
Even if it is in very well expressed in a second language, because he's very, very intelligent. And he always has been, ever since he was a kid and he was first in the Monaco team. I think he understands the meaning of absolutely everything he says. And the way that things have changed between him and Paris Saint-Germain over the last year and a half is... he realises that, as you say, they've made him a superstar. And I think, even though he won't quite say it publicly, he realises that he's the captain of that ship and not Neymar. Mm. Therefore, if you're at the helm, what can you do? You can set the future sporting project, like Messi has at Barcelona to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. While he is there, the sporting direction that Paris Saint-Germain takes, it all has to work towards Mbappe's ambitions and towards his timeline. And, you know, he's been here before saying what he expects. And I think in terms of the sensible transfer window they did last summer and going back to those young players, what was very controversial is them cleaning house of a lot of young players with Nkunku moving on. Moussa Diaby went to Leverkusen as well, and moving on that sort of talent, especially Nkunku, actually, who went to Leipzig, who...
he's been good.
Could come in. Yeah, he's been good for Leipzig and he could come in and make a contribution for Paris Saint-Germain. He did that before. I don't expect Kylian Mbappe to be a Paris Saint-Germain lifer. He will make a move to an absolute mega club at some point. I would still kind of expect that to be Real Madrid, not just in line with his childhood ambitions.
What about time frame, though?
I think 2 or 3 years down the line, maybe.
Right. Okay. So not anytime soon.
I don't think there's any massive rush to do it. Obviously, in terms of extending his contract, in terms of being paid well, and in terms of having that sort of influence, he holds all the aces at the moment because he's the player who they want to keep beyond all other. I think the fact is, and it's easy to diminish his role in this, but Unai Emery, actually, when he was coach of PSG, was the first guy to come out publicly and say, Mbappe, why don't you come back here? You know, this is your throne. Take it. Paris is your town. Take it. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting that he ended up doing that. It's funny because if Niko Kovac had said something similar as coach of Bayern, they would have said, shut up. We're not interested in your opinion. But this was before Emery's, I guess, status was diminished to quite that extent. I think Mbappe is very keen on that role and is very keen
right.
on that status. But speaking good English, coming out there and speaking good English is not insignificant because it shows that actually I am adaptable. I am international. I can, not only do I want to be the head of a more international Paris Saint-Germain, which is something that they've always been aiming for, but I've got enough intelligence and independence to go out there and do it on my own if I want to, if you don't satisfy my ambition.
Figo che ha segnato due gol in questa edizione della Champions League contro il Genk, soprattutto contro il Manchester United nella gara del Bernabeu. Parte, attenzione, para Buffon! E probabilmente questo è un intervento decisivo.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
We are the one-stop shop, of course, for Erling Braut Haaland news here on the continent.
Of course.
And he made his debut at Borussia Dortmund from the bench at Augsburg last
Didn't
week.
He just...
Augsburg. Let's call the whole thing off. He came on after 55 minutes with the score 3-1 to Augsburg and promptly scored a hat-trick and had the most...
Of course he did.
I'd say probably the most devastating impact of any sub I've seen in many a year.
It was quite remarkable.
It was like a kid, an older kid, walking into a younger kid's bedroom and stomping all over his Lego. with his profile and like his physical makeup, he has the look of a man playing against boys, like whenever he takes the field. Incredible performance for a man stepping up to what we all assume and I suppose accept is a higher level.
Yeah.
Lars, presumably you've been in big contact with Erling since.
Well, he did actually, I mean, famously, he doesn't enjoy speaking to the media. He's quite forthright about this. He was asked how he so sold in interviews a while back, and he said, because I'm really bored. And the reporter followed up, are you bored right now? It's like, yes.
He's a character, isn't he?
Well, he's weird because he's extremely confident, but not in a sort of extrovert way.
Apart from when he's listening to the Champions League anthem in his
car. He's very confident about the fact he doesn't need to impress anyone in the media. He just wants to play football. He wants to work hard and be a better footballer, and he doesn't want to spend time speaking to journalists. But they did actually manage to get an 8-minute chat with him after this game, and I was just surprised he went 8 minutes without scoring a goal. I mean, that's quite quite poor for him. A lot of that 8 minutes was actually Jan Åge Fjørtoft asking questions, because, you know, trying to get Fjørtoft is a man of many words, and also trying to get stuff out of Holland, you need to work hard. But no, it was remarkable. And there are a couple of things here. One of it is just another example of the fact that just nothing fazes him at all. And we've seen this throughout his sort of recent career, is that you just throw him into, send him down to Austria and keep banging in goals, you know, put him into the Champions League and keep banging in goals, put him into, like, he just doesn't care. Like, it doesn't seem to be any sort of concept to him that this is somehow meant to be harder and there's meant to be more pressure. He just takes it so completely in a stride, and that is remarkable. And the other thing is, just from a tactical perspective, you can see immediately that Dortmund have been crying out for this sort of player. You can see immediately that he gave them, he kind of of a reference point, someone for all these sort of creative guys to aim at. And it was interesting, like the second goal is tap in from like 0 yards, but you know, but the first goal and the third one is a good sort of ball in behind that he runs onto. And if he's, they don't really have anyone else who sort of runs off the last defender like he does. I mean, he's a big old unit, but he does work the channels, as you'd say, and he does run. And they have so many players in this team who can play balls like that for him, but they don't really have anyone else who makes those kind of runs.
Well, Lars, you mentioned to me before, I think, that, as a preamble to this question, there's a kind of a feeling in football that if you're a striker and you're big and tall and strong, you're automatically a hold-up man, in quotes, and that's how you get pigeonholed. And we've seen it happen with Lukaku, and we've talked about it here.
And it's not that kind of so long, yeah.
With Brad Haaland, is it a situation that when he was 15 or 16, he wasn't quite the size he is now, and he's grown quite late? And so so what he's had to do is develop as a footballer technically, and now he's added those physical characteristics to his game, alongside the fact that he's mentally unflappable, means he's just a perfect package.
I mean, that's definitely part of it, and I could show you, but it would make for terrible podcasting. But a guy who works at Bruna, his Holland's first club, recently put out this fella who does video analysis for Bruna put out a short video clip of just 10 seconds of Haaland running onto the pitch.
And we can share that on social media later.
Yeah, for his first, we can link to the tweet anyway. For his first ever senior game for Bruna's second team in the fourth tier of Norwegian football. He was 15 years and 13 days old then. Yeah. And you see this sort of quite gawky, sort of thin kid with like kind of spindly legs back then. It's like he is not, you look at him now and you think the guy's a beast. But when he learned the game, he would get boshed around by defenders quite a lot. And he had to learn how to use space and all this sort of thing. So yeah, that's a huge factor. And now he has the sort of size that once he's gone past you, you're not gonna get around him again. Yeah. You can't brush him off the ball. So I think, of course, he's not gonna play Augsburg every week, but you could definitely see just from that cameo, goals aside, that he adds something very specific that Dortmund attack is lacks.
What I like is the fact that the social media team at Dortmund are clearly OTC listeners, Lars, because or watchers of that fantastic video that I can't think of a more evocative clip that there's been in recent months, when you were talking about one of his hat tricks, and it just had a picture of Haaland on their Instagram feed with the match ball from the Augsburg game, and it said, "He's only been in town 3 weeks, but he's got a new girlfriend already."
That's top work.
Classic.
Yeah.
And no, you say he's not going to be playing Augsburg every week, but their next game is at home to Cologne. And after that,
dreadful on the road, yeah.
And then after that, they're at home to Union Berlin. He could have 15 goals before he's even...
Cologne have actually had a bit of a surge in form recently. But forget I said that. Carry on.
Yeah, no, I mean, they do concede almost 2 goals a game.
Yeah,
they're bad away from home though. Notably, Cologne have got something like 2 wins, 1 draw, and 6 defeats on the road so far this season. So you'd back them to have a terrible time going to Dortmund. No,
it's going
to
be goals.
And your fellow countryman, Lars, Roy Keane. No, I mentioned your fellow countryman Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was at great pains this week to protest way too much about how he doesn't like dealing with certain agents. And that's why I didn't sign Haaland.
I mean, without giving the Ramble lawyers too much work, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not someone who should talk about agents and the right way to deal with agents and the morality of that. And I'm not going to go any further. You can Google this if you're interested.
There we go. It's already out there. Let's talk a bit about Jurgen Klinsmann as well, shall we? Now, it was revealed a week or two ago that he didn't have the documentation needed to coach in the Bundesliga. I imagine that was just an admonition. It seemed to have been cleared up fairly quickly. I
mean, do you know how it was cleared up?
He successfully renewed it ahead of the Bayern game, but I don't know how exactly.
Well, he said he had the right documents, but they were at his house in California in a drawer somewhere.
Right.
So, which seems like a metaphor, right? For the Klinsmann project, like my coaching badges are in a drawer somewhere. And they're like, I can do this, guys. Yeah. It's all good.
Well, it's funny because basically what he did is he got a friend to go into his house, find the documents, photograph them on his phone, and then send them to the German FA, who, in lieu of having the actual documents, and I realise this does sound very bureaucratic, it got a 3-week extension to get them in.
However, so he rifled through a drawer, discarded all the 80s kind of like pawn picks, and then found the coach in the docks. But the press had a field day with the story. Is that just because Klinsmann's reputation in Germany is as it is?
Well, because...
How was he seen in Germany, for example?
Well, you know what? I think you have to go back to the beginning and say, as a coach, the cultural impression he made on Germany, and certainly the way that Germany and German football looked at itself with the work that he did at the 2006 World Cup, is notable and remains notable. I mean, that wasn't just a revolution in terms of Germany having a decent team again. It was a revolution in the way that Germany and expressing national pride, certainly through the medium of the football team, it was a revolution in how they felt about themselves. So Klinsmann was a huge part of that. However, the fact that two things, the fact that Jogi Löw then took over, and he was always the tactical brains behind it, and there was no hiding that. There was never any hiding that. I think the fact that Jogi Löw has gone on to do so well on his own is one thing. And the second thing is what Klinsmann did at Bayern, and he tried to change too much too quickly. He tried to reinvent the wheel there.
Too many Buddhas.
Yeah, definitely too many Buddhas.
Tell us more about that.
He put little statues of Buddha around the training ground. And Bayern is a very say what you mean club. Mm. And a few notable players came out and said, look,
they said no to Buddha.
Yeah, this is nonsense. And
his insistence on signing Landon Donovan was confusing as well.
That was big. And of course he didn't last very long there. Because I think to try and change the culture at a club like Bayern, which has got such a strong sense of its own culture, well, let's be clear. And the fact that he ended up in California afterwards
and hasn't coached since at club level. Sorry,
no, that's true, and it's an absolutely big deal. And some would say, is he doing it to that extent now? Because you know, we talked about Jogi Löw being the brains behind Germany tactically before he even took the helm himself solely. The fact that the assistant to Klinsmann is Alexander Nuri, who was the head coach of Werder Bremen, that has not gone unnoticed. And he is someone who is going to be responsible for the tactics of Hertha. And there's a huge sense that Klinsmann is just the figurehead. The fact is, when he came out for his first home game against Dortmund, there was, you know, this huge like array of photographers in front of the bench. And he was also doing a video of himself on his phone for their club channel. Now, Klinsmann's
and
not coming.
They lost.
Yeah, yeah. they played okay, yeah. but Klinsmann's not coming completely cold. He's come in because he was already advising the board after Lars Windhorst made this investment. He was brought in, and it's meant to make the club more visible, more sexy. And it's been thrown back at them quite a lot, as you can imagine, in the aftermath of that battering by Bayern. The talk that they want to make the most of being a big city club.
Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, Ryan Hunt spoke about it a few weeks ago on the show, didn't he? Talking about how
the problem is, we go back to when Ryan was talking to us about it, and their big plans to use January to spend all this money. They're struggling to spend it.
Yeah,
you've got to get people to want to come.
Yeah, and you say they want to spend all this money, but it's not like this is not. We're not talking Abu Dhabi or Qatar money. Like it's about spending 25 million on Granit Xhaka or something like this. I mean, I'm not sure how transformative that will be. And listen, I think we had a good chat with Ryan about this because it's easy to laugh at Hertha, right? Because there are many words you can use about the modern Hertha Berlin. They're quite underwhelming and not what a big Berlin club should be, really, demographics considered and all of this sort of thing.
Are you saying not attractive?
Well, as Ryan very astutely reminded us, they are still a club that have a big fan base and they are still a club that have an identity and have a history. And I think the impression you get is that Klinsmann is kind of doing it again, the sort of culturally sticking his Buddha in it, so to speak. the sort of blue sky thinking that got him in trouble at Bayern, the holistic approach and the Buddhas and all this sort of stuff. At Hertha, he's already annoyed people by talking about how, like, Hoffenheim and RB Leipzig being vorbild. What's the word for that in English?
Examples.
Models. Examples. Yeah, models. Sorry. And and that is like for German football fans, that's not what you want to hear. Like in the strictly sporting sense, those two clubs are a great example of building something from nothing and creating something. But Hertha fans would argue that they are not nothing and that they have a history, and the sort of investment model that Hoffenheim and Leipzig have followed is anathema to an awful lot of supporters in Germany. And that is not the way to ingratiate yourself with your new fan base, to point to the two most hated clubs in the league and say, hey guys, this is what we sort of look up to now. Like this, it's not, yeah. If it was like a football stock market and you could short a club, I'd be all over shorting them.
What is the problem with Hertha then? Because it's an amazing city. It's a great place to live. It's very interesting. There's loads of stuff to do there.
Yeah.
Ryan seemed to intimate it from what I remember when I listened to the show. I wasn't on that one, but I listened to it back and he was saying, look, it's not great they're in this huge stadium, which they can't fill.
That is a massive deal.
But can that be the sole reason, though?
No, it's not the sole reason, but it is a big reason. I think you look at this game against Bayern, for example. Bayern, who have supporters not just in Munich, but from all over Germany. And in a situation like this, you look at Hertha had kept Bayern just about at arm's length for almost an hour. Then Thomas Müller scores a very like Arsenal in the 80s kind of goal, you know, cross to the back post, nodded down by Perisic, and then Müller smashes it in. And then after that, they absolutely fall down like a house of cards. And I think that really is carries on to the second point, the fact that they are looking not just for sexy players, but for a certain type of experience. The fact that they've looked at Xhaka, they've looked at Kevin Strootman, they're still trying to get Luka Tusar from Neil.
Is anyone in like European football, like you've had a massive cash injection, what do we need? We need Kevin Strootman.
No, I take your point totally. Marseille are saying you need Kevin Strootman.
Can you please bring his knees with him?
Yeah, but I think that idea of having gravitas, not in terms of like say when Manchester City were taken over by Rubinho, but the idea that they are trying to get what they see as experience in the right place of the team, because at the moment they don't have that, not just that big club mentality in terms of their playing squad, but they don't really have that right, we're going to fight to win this game sort of mentality. And that's where the idea of signing Xhaka comes from, doesn't it?
For sure. I'm just saying, if your role models are Leipzig and Hoffenheim and you want to build something, then look at what they actually did, which is focus on youth.
Yeah.
Or if you want to generate enthusiasm, by all means, make a splashy big signing, but don't make it Kevin Strootman.
No.
But I think you've been a bit unfair, because I mean, you bring in the Man City thing there. Fine, Man City did bring in these certain players, huge name players or whatever, but they also spent a lot of time realising that it was a process and it was going to take a while for them to be in the... The reason they got Rubinho is because of his agent, because he thought he was going somewhere else and because he was an absolute mercenary, right? They also signed players like Gareth Barry, Julian Lescott, Roque Santa Cruz.
Absolutely.
So there is a process here. Hertha Berlin, no matter how much money they've got, and I know you're saying they haven't got as much money as the Qataris or the Abu Dhabi Investment Group, but if you are going to do it, it's a process. You aren't going to go and get Mbappe.
Come and play for Hertha.
And you know what? You're not going to do it in January either.
No, right.
That's the big problem for them. Where they are at the moment, though, is trying to make that big media splash, trying to do it mid-season, and trying to do it in a situation where, you know what? They can't be looking to Europe. They have to make sure they don't get relegated.
Yeah.
And they could do with finishing as the top club in Berlin, which is not a given.
My big takeaway from this game was that his goal means Thomas Müller now finally has scored as many goals as Erling Braut Haaland in the Bundesliga this season.
How many more minutes?
Past
1,000?
Pretty much. Actually, uncanny, Luke. Exactly 1,050 minutes.
There we go.
But big moment for him, I'm sure.
Zidane, le falcate. Figo anticipato, palla che sembra essere buona ancora per Del Piero, attenzione Del Piero contro Hierro, una serie di dribbling, lo fa cadere, gol! Alex Del Piero raddoppia, ha giocato, ha beffato.
Braga have had a great week, they beat Porto away in the league, still have a decent chance of Europa League football next season, and are in the Taça da Liga final thanks to a win over Sporting. They'll play Porto in the final on Saturday, and he's going to explain the quite baffling format to that competition in a minute. The game against Sporting was a frankly ridiculous game, which saw Braga score a last-minute winner to make it 2-1. There were four red cards in the game. Yannick Bolasie, Jeremy Mathieu and Christian Borco were all sent off for Sporting, with Wilson Eduardo sent off for the Mino Warriors. Aside from the fact that Jeremy Mathieu scored caused a riot with one of the worst tackles, so dumb that I don't even think it was a tackle. I think he crossed the border between late tackle and off the ball incident without even meaning to do so.
Sure.
It did, didn't it?
It was really stupid.
And talk to me a bit about that game, and also talk to us about the format of this competition that Braga have seen themselves in the final of this Saturday.
Yeah, we'll explain the Tasta Liga format first, because I think it's quite interesting, especially in a season where France is bringing their League Cup to an end.
Yeah, and Spain are doing something similar to this in
the Supercopa.
Yeah,
they've kind of copied it, really.
Yeah,
The idea of having this Final Four, and they've had it for this must be the third year that they've done it in the Tasa de Liga, in that you have a single venue, and you have the four semi-finalists, and you have Tuesday semi-final, Wednesday semi-final, Saturday final, all in the same stadium.
Yeah.
So I quite like that as a format. It's quite interesting.
Well, it feels innovative, is kind of what people need.
Yeah, and it's inexpensive as well. The tickets aren't expensive. Not that that's filled the stadium up this week.
It's a great stadium to visit, though.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. And it was in Braga last year as well, so they were happy with the way it went. It's really weird seeing Benfica not in the Final Four, because it's traditionally, since the Taça da Liga, which is a relatively young competition in Portugal, has started up, it's been Benfica's competition. They've won it a pile of times. This Braga Sporting game was absolutely astonishing. And I don't know if you, the thing is, you can't say 8-man Sporting finished the game, can you? Because the red cards happened to players. Eduardo wasn't on the pitch when he got sent off.
Oh, he just wanted to be involved. He was on the bench. Yeah.
And the other Eduardo who wasn't on, who got sent off, was Braga's Eduardo, the one who spent the short spell at Chelsea. Goalkeeper who looks like he's carved out of granite.
Yeah.
He could be behind
the
goals.
From the quarry, exactly.
Yeah, there's
also
no
not on the pitch when he was sent off.
Absolutely.
Big fan of subs getting sent off.
I don't want to get too beardy about the game, because I know a lot of people listening won't have seen it.
But you can see free highlights of all Portuguese games
on YouTube.
On V Sports, on YouTube.
That's on YouTube as well, yeah. That's what you meant. Yannick Bolasie getting sent off. I felt this was a real key moment in this game, because Yannick Bolasie goes to close down a Braga player.
Sequeira.
Yeah, and he slips.
Yeah.
And as he slips, he goes over the top of the ball. In quite what I would say, if you can describe any of those kind of incidents as benign, it was the most benign example you would see of it. And the referee sends him off.
After a VAR consultation.
Quite.
And it's high studs, I guess, what the ref is seeing.
But what happens then is the referee essentially doesn't understand that he's starting to cause this ill feeling, and he refuses to take control of it. Now the players need to take ultimate responsibility, but that decision there.
You are saying this like someone who's a pundit on Portuguese TV. I'm enjoying it.
Just fuming about it.
Yeah. Get after the ref.
Yeah.
If you were accompanied by half an hour of footage, this is a Portuguese footballing
I just
TV
think the referee
program.
The referee needs to understand the context of that decision he makes. Because what happens after that is, of course, Sporting get frustrated because they're about to miss out on going to a final, and that's what Mathieu does, even though he's popped up with a great goal, by the way, amazing finish. What is he even doing up there?
Yeah.
He then gets sent off in a quite childish way.
And he's a really clean hitter of the ball. People forget he played for Barcelona and was pretty good.
Yeah, we really do forget that.
It is quite easy to forget that, though.
The Bolasie one, I have to say, you rarely see a red card where you feel that sympathetic with the player whilst also feeling that it has to be a red. Because it is completely accidental.
It was officious, though. It was officious.
It's completely accidental. Yeah. For Bolasie, but you're still responsible for where your limbs end up, and his limb ended up almost like twanging someone else's limb, and that is, you know, it did endanger him, but it was completely accidental.
I kind of wonder if this happens quite a lot with new light football boots. Don't you think we see more studs up tackles than we used to?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, 100%.
And I don't think there's a great deal of support in very light new football boots. Now, as someone who, when I rarely play football, I don't make any tackles ever. So it's good. It's almost like playing barefoot. But if you're someone who tackles, like if you plant your foot down, it's going
to
slide.
There's two points on that. One, to expand that further, one is that players, because they have no protection in the upper of their football boot, now use the sole of their foot as protection.
Yes.
You see a lot more studs up challenges.
Yeah.
Secondly, you see a lot more metatarsal injuries because there's no support for the front of the foot. So in my opinion, what the boot manufacturers have done, have traded protection and support for speed, because the game's all about pace now. Mm. So what they're trying to do is make the lightest football boot possible. There was a presentation, I think Nike Town, a couple of years ago, where the boot they had there was so light, it was being suspended, like levitating on like jets of air.
Right.
On the pedestal, and that was their our lightest boot ever. About 150 grams of a boot or something. But what it's not giving is protection for the players who play in the positions where they've got to tackle. There's so much more protection by putting your studs up.
But if they end up doing that regularly, that needs to get coached out of them, because you're going to get sent off and cost your team, though.
Of course, but they're terrified of being injured. Yeah, they'd rather be suspended for a game than go out for 3 months because they've broken their foot.
Either way, I think the interesting thing about this card is the way it affected the game, because Braga were better with 11 than they were with 10, I felt. And they needed this, as you say, late goal from Paulinho. And again, I think that's what influences what happens next with Mathieu. He's got his team back into the game with this beautiful goal. And it's him who loses Paulinho at the back post. And for that to happen with an experienced... At the second post...
You just
post,
have to kick him.
With an experienced, left-sided centre-half stroke left back. I mean, he must be so annoyed with himself. After they played really well, having got themselves back into the game, a man down. And then it's just him knocking off that lets Paulinho, who's been on a good streak, by the way, just nod it in a really simple goal at the far post to take Braga into the final. But the job that Ruben Amorim is doing at Braga is incredible.
Well, let's talk about him then, because he's 34. He retired from playing at just 30. He was Braga's reserve team coach, but was upped to the big chair when Ricardo Sapinto was sacked back in September.
Yeah, Ricardo Sapinto, we have to say, he didn't hit anyone to get fired.
Absolutely
this
didn't.
2 days before Christmas, the only things notable that happened for him is, just to summarise in three lines, good in the Europa League, 6 defeats in 14 league games, and got thrown off a Ryanair flight.
Great.
That's great. His half season with Braga.
That's why Portugal is so underrated. But it's not often we say this about a manager, but Ruben Amorim is. In fact, I think it might be the first time I've ever said it. At the time of recording, he's currently won every single game he's coached in top flight football.
That's not bad. And his debut in top flight football, they won 7-1 away at Belenenses.
Also, what I'm saying is, prick your ears up, Everton fans. He could be the new Marco Silva.
I just don't.
It's a great story, though, isn't it? It's an interesting story.
I just don't want to move away from Sapinto being chucked off a Ryanair flight so quickly. He looks like a man who shouldn't be on Ryanair to begin with. Like, I don't.
But they
think
all
anyone...
do it because of the convenience, don't they?
But the hair,
EasyJet, Ryanair,
you
know, that
you
kind of stuff.
But the hair is
Porto Tafaro. Yeah,
yeah. The most luscious hair ever to be seen on a Ryanair flight, possibly.
Yeah, and do you know what? There is some like sort of quite lustrous hair in Portuguese
really
football,
is.
Isn't there? So that's saying something. But Amorim's a really interesting character. I mean, he's talked quite at length about his coaching philosophy, despite this being his first top flight job. Now, what I think so interesting about him is he's not only so open about his philosophy, he's so open about his personality shortcomings, which is something I think is fascinating. I mean, he did a really interesting in-depth interview, like when he was first doing a postgraduate course, which Mourinho was one of the lecturers on, actually.
Nice.
This is going back a couple of years when he knew he was going to try and make it in coaching. And he said, I wasn't one of those guys who always thought I would be a coach. He was someone who was a talker without trying to be a talker,
right,
on the pitch. And so I think other people suggested it to him, and he had a bit of a think about what he was going to do.
Did he have to retire due to injury then?
Yeah, that's right. He didn't want to be a sporting director because he's not that good at getting on with people. He didn't want to be a pundit because it simply didn't interest him. So he almost came to coaching by default from doing this course and then diversifying into coaching. And he had a bad start to his coaching career because he took on Casapia, a Lisbon club who were then in the third tier, I guess. And basically, he was meant to be, he didn't have the correct qualifications to be the head coach. So they got in someone else to officially be the head coach while he would really be the manager of the team.
Mm.
But he couldn't contain himself, so he would come up onto the touchline, move everyone else out of the way, and start directing the players on the pitch. And the Portuguese league stepped in and said, you can't do that. You're not qualified.
Yeah.
And so basically what they did is they fined Casapia. They took 6 points off them and they banned him from coaching for a year. And this is when he's a real greenhorn.
And they said, no, they're just in the drawer in California.
No, that's right. My gag is in a drawer in California. Yeah, yeah. So basically, they appealed. They got the points back, but he resigned anyway. And he'd always said, going back before that, before he became a coach, I've got to be better at containing it. Because he was someone who was coached by Jorge Jesus, both at Belenenses and Benfica, for a combined total of probably about 6-7 years.
Mm.
And they fell out a lot. He said, I had great moments with Jesus and not so great moments with Jesus. And he said what he found so difficult about it. Jesus is such an intense bloke. Like, everything is on top of players. He's on their case all the time. And, you know, that's expressed in the football. It is kind of this attacking festival. And I know, like, people who watch South American football have seen a bit of that with Flamengo. And he's a transformative type of coach. Now, the interesting thing is, when he was at Braga, Amorim played under Leonardo Jardim, who's far more, I want the players to lead it kind of coach. He's a bit more holistic. And so he's someone who doesn't flog the players physically, who wants them to have fun with the ball and all that sort of stuff. So he's ended up at this kind of midpoint. Also think, and I don't really want to make the comparison in terms of them as coaches, and especially as Amorim is such a green coach, but I think, you know, when we talk about what sort of coach someone is compared to the player they were. And I think sometimes you can read too much into that.
So Amorim was like a central midfield player.
He's a utility player.
Yeah.
They just put him anywhere.
He played fullback as well.
He played right back. He played a central midfield, wide midfield, all over the place. And he was kind of a bit undercut in terms of his career, and people underrated him because they thought of him as a jack of all trades, master of none, even though, like, Portugal found him quite a useful, like, tournament player to have in the squad. Mm. But I think when you're a player like that who, A, plays all over the place, B, is injured a lot, and C, maybe isn't first pick even when he is playing.
Yeah.
I think if you look at, say, Nuno, for example, at Wolves, he's someone who I think his coaching style has developed quite naturally because he spent so much time watching the game when he was a player.
Right.
And I think being part of it, but not being in it, gives you a different perspective.
It's a really interesting point.
I think that's worked quite well for Amorim as well.
All right, it's time for Games of the Week. My favourite part of it. I'm sure it's your favourite part of it as well. Last week, Real Madrid 2, Sevilla 1 was my pick. The rarest of beasts, a Casemiro brace, settled this one. Andy, you had Sporting 0, Benfica 2.
Yes.
A late show from substitute Rafa settled this one. He's had a good goal scoring time of it, like, last season, but he's been played a bit more of a cameo role this year, hasn't he?
Well, he's been injured. Mm. He got a serious thigh injury that's kept him out for a while. Benfica have really missed him, because to have a playmaker with that sort of pace as well, it's a game changer, especially in the Portuguese league.
Well, he made a big difference in that one. Lars, you took on the Leipzig 3 Union Berlin game.
Yeah, good versus evil in the Bundesliga.
The evil empire won out.
Evil did triumph, yeah.
To the chagrin of strikes back.
To the chagrin of football purists everywhere, presumably you included in that.
Well, but also aesthetically, I mean, there was an absolutely belting goal by Timo Werner, worth looking up. I mean,
beautiful.
Oh my God, there's a man in form. Yeah. Good Lord. No, good value for the win, RB Leipzig. And they look an awful lot like a team who might win the league, which brings me to my game of the week this week.
Well, you go first then, Lars, because you've absolutely steamrolled your way into first.
I have, there, so. Because I want to watch Bayern Munich Schalke, and this is a fixture you should always watch anyway, because this is a lot of aggro and all this. But because Schalke look like a semi-credible force under David Wagner, he's done a tremendously good job. Those who follow this Huddersfield team maybe not surprised by that. He's a very good coach, clearly. I think in Germany, he's maybe done a little bit better than people were expecting, trying to become the latest sort of drummer in Spinal Tap who tries to figure out how to make Schalke work. It's a very... But after Domenico Tedesco did, in fact, spontaneously combust. It's the most poisoned of chalices, but David Wagner's done a tremendous job so far, made them very compact and hard to beat. Still a bit short on quality, maybe, for a team to fight right at the top, but certainly they have enough about them to give Bayern a game, you should think. And
Lars, what's the situation with Alex Neubel for that game?
I would assume, I haven't read anything about it.
He probably won't play. They'll play Schubert.
They've been playing Schubert, but I thought that's because Neubel was suspended.
Yeah, but the question has always been, do they want to just throw him in there? They want to look at Schubert as their possible future lineup, number one? Yeah, okay. I think he'll play.
We'll see. It would be fun if Neubel played, but it would also be a potentially difficult decision, I guess.
If Neubel plays, I'll watch it. Put it out there.
You know what? Leon Goretzka didn't do great playing against Bayern after he joined them, but before he'd left.
Best tears since Laudrup.
Yeah, definitely. you know, I wanted to ask you actually about the David Wagner thing, Lars. As they are wildly overperforming against the XG model.
Yeah.
Oh God.
German Burnley.
But I mean, they do play a sort of an energetic, sort of positive, like they like doing things with the ball. I think that's slightly unfair. They're not sort of long ball merchants.
I thought I had you there. As an aside,
I am a bit sad that Sporting aren't playing again, because after the Jeremy Matthews sending off, I kind of wanted to see if he would be committing some more random acts of violence.
But you think that, right? I was normal at that sometimes, and then I remind myself that kind of stuff just happens in Portugal all the time.
Yeah, so but that's why. Like,
you'll never find someone else doing it.
But actually, Andy, I'm not sure. Does the Tasa de Liga sendings off, do they carry on? I mean, does it mean he's banned for the next one?
Yeah, it'll be banned in the next league game.
And
yeah,
this is when it makes sense.
Well, the next
Because it looked to me like the challenge of someone just had somewhere to be next week.
Yeah.
Like maybe he has a wedding or something.
Nolan before Christmas.
Boxing Day off.
We had this in Norway a few years back. We had a player who actually had somewhere to be, and he asked the ref before the game, Raymond Kvist, his name was, he asked the ref before the game, like, ref, can you make sure, because he was one booking away from suspension and he had somewhere to be. He asked the ref, can you make sure you book me for something at some point? But this guy was like a really creative winger who never tracked back or made any attempt to win the ball. So it's kind of hard to book him. Like,
essentially corruption.
So actually the ref had to go over and poke him towards the end of the game, saying, mate, you've not given me a reason to book you yet. Like, I want to play ball here, but you've got to give me something. And he was like, oh yeah, sure. So the next time he blew up for a foul, Kvistvik just went over to belt the ball into touch. just for no reason at all.
It reminds me of a story I heard from an ex-Scottish player who I won't name, who was talking about how the fact that every referee in the 80s was known as being Protestant or Catholic in the Glasgow area, and he was playing for Rangers, and he said we were 1-0 up and playing against obviously they're playing against a Catholic team, let's say Hibs. And the referee had played about 6 minutes of injury time. This is well before I don't think the game was being televised or anything like that. And this player went up to the referee when there was another corner to the other team and said, fuck me, ref, how long left? And the referee turned to him and went, till we get one, son. Anyway, my game of the week is I'm going to go for the Rome derby. Lazio, after being knocked out of the cup, a trophy they won last season, of course, need to bounce back. A win against Roma, particularly in the knowledge that Juve have got a tricky away game at the San Paolo, is absolutely vital. Sunday tea time.
Did you see Ciro Immobile's penalty?
He's an absolute machine.
But did you, I haven't seen
the penalty, no.
This was in the quarterfinal against Napoli of the Coppa Italia this week. A game that, okay, spoiler alert, my game of the week is Napoli versus Juventus. So
nice.
You can watch them in a row because this is Sunday night. Maybe, right. You know, go for a little bit of light tea in between. And
couple of cannoli.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Napoli's win was... like the way they celebrated it at the end, there was this moment, probably about like 5-10 minutes from the end, and they won 1-0 Napoli over Lazio, who'd won 11 in a row, where Lorenzo Insigne, who'd scored a brilliant goal 2 minutes in, which ended up being the winner, he was tracking back his fullback, and he knocked it off him and won Napoli a goal kick, and he was like pumping his fists and revving up the crowd like it was a goal or something like that. It just meant so much. I mean, Gattuso simply looked exhausted at the end of it. They needed this this win so badly. I mean, to put it into a Serie A context, of course, Juventus beat Roma 3-1 in their Coppa Italia quarterfinal. And they were, as they've been a lot, especially in Serie A and especially at home this season, they were clinical, really. Roma had their chances, didn't make the most of them. Buffon had a pretty good game, and Roma will have been a bit disappointed with some of their defending.
But the further context of that Lazio win, though, Andy, was the fact that didn't Lazio beat Napoli quite fortuitously in the league like the week before?
Yeah.
Because Ospina made an error and Immobile scored late on.
Yeah, that's right. So like 10 days before. So Ospina made a dreadful mistake that led to Immobile's goal. Also, the fact that they ended up playing a bit of it, more quite a large part of it, with 10 men, Napoli. But it ended up 10 against 10 quite quickly because Lucas Leiva got two yellow cards in the same action foul and then for gobbing off.
The old Balotelli.
No, but big, the old Balotelli big fan, one too. I mean, I think actually it was like, it didn't see. I mean, it wasn't the worst case of gobbing off you'll ever see. I'm a big fan of the refs giving the second yellow. Anyway.
Yeah, but the Immobile penalty, which, you know, you thought just Napoli's luck because Hussai gave away the penalty and it looked like they had the chance for a quick equaliser. Do you remember the Beckham penalty against Turkey?
Yeah.
Where his feet just, like, the ground just
plants his foot,
goes from under him. That happened to Immobile. A guy who's been able to do no wrong in front of goal. That's exactly the break that Napoli needed. It still doesn't make me convinced that they can beat Juventus, but it did feel like a moment of, whew, you know, we really needed that. So it's given them a little bit of a boost before they play their old coach Sarri and his team.
This was a Stakhanov production.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.